It's nice to see everybody here, and we're going to give a shout and a shot at doing a workshop on steps 4 and 5, and we'll see where that goes. And this isn't going to be a technical presentation. That's something that I do with guys I sponsor, and you're taking people through the work for the first time. And so a couple disclaimers. If I say anything up here in the next hour that doesn't line up with what your sponsors have taught you, what you've been taught in Alcoholics Anonymous, what works for you, your approach, that doesn't mean that you're wrong and I'm right or I'm wrong. And it just means we're going about it a different way. Having said that, I'm probably right. But and I hope you feel you're right, too. And the thing about inventory, and hopefully I'll be able to weave this in, is one of the things I certainly was guilty of, and you'll hear this from time to time in AA, is that, I wrote a 4-step. I did that when I was new. And now I live in 10, 11, and 12. And that's what the book tells me. And I'm like, well, that's fine. I see I can connect the dots to that type of thinking. But I'll also tell you that it kind of flies in the way of one of the first things I heard in Alcoholics Anonymous, which is one day at a time. And this idea that I can't stay sober today on yesterday's program. And that I have to have something. And the steps are built in a circle. They're not built in an ascending manner. You know, you think of steps, you think you go to the top and you hit a plateau and you go, there's the steps I just took and I'm done. But that doesn't work that way. If you've been here any length of time, you realize they're actually in a circle, and you go around and around and around, and that can be several times in one day, depending what you're dealing with. So this idea, everything that we talk about in Alcoholics Anonymous falls under the label for me as a spiritual tool. So I have to think about what the spiritual tools are and how I'm using them. So let's talk about, in order to talk about steps 4 and 5, we have to briefly get there, don't we? And I'll tell you my experience. I got sober September 16th, 1991. That puts me coming up on the 32-year mark. And I'm like everybody else that comes to Alcoholics Anonymous, right? I got no problem with the first step. But here's my understanding of the first step. Yep, I am powerless over that demon liquor and all that other stuff I use to make sure I can drink more demon liquor. And that's where it stops. That's my understanding of the first step. It goes no further than that. There's nothing else that's even in the equation for being powerless. And that's not egotistical on my part. That's not arrogant on my part. That's just that the destruction of active alcoholism in my life is so profound, I'm not really thinking about my finances, my sex life, my relationships, my family, my business life. I'm not thinking about any of that. I got something that's got me by the throat and is killing me. So when you talk about powerless, I'm obviously going to only identify with the thing that's actually ripping the skin off of my life at that moment. So that's my understanding of the first step. And because of that, to a degree, I'm brainwashed, aren't I? Right? There's a description of an alcoholic in the doctor's opinion, which is every newcomer in the history of Alcoholics Anonymous has wanted to be this description of an alcoholic. And Silkworth talks about psychopaths. Silkworth talks about, then there's the guy who's always making promises but can't keep them. And then it comes to my favorite one. And then there's the type of alcoholic that's absolutely normal in every respect. Except that the effect that alcohol has on him. And when we're new, we're all like, that's me. I am a wonderful human being, just ask me. Except when you put alcohol in my system. And one of the reasons I've been brainwashed into believing this is the brainwashing isn't conducted by myself, it's conducted by the people that know me the best and love me the most. The well-meaning people in our lives. I've been surrounded by love during that descent into hell, right? So these people, what are they saying to a guy like me? You're a great guy. You got a lot of potential. You could probably be anything you wanted to be if you just quit drinking. All your dreams would come true if you just quit drinking. Everything would work out if you just quit drinking. And I laid my experience against that, and what do I see? Went to jail, I'm drinking, smacked that guy I was drinking, blew up the relationship I was drinking. It's easy for me to blame whiskey as the culprit. But then I come to Alcoholics Anonymous, and you start saying bizarre things to me in the beginning that fly in the face of that information. Like, alcohol is not your problem, it's your solution. And I think, well, the Los Angeles Police Department would like to debate that with you, right? And it's easy for me to say that's cute, but you don't really understand. Because I'm convinced, I have this idea that if I can just put the plug in the jug, if I could just stay sober long enough, that wonderful human being that I vaguely remember, those ghosty, gray memories of the time where we didn't have to be drunk to take a deep breath. When I wore a young man's clothes and all I needed was an athletic field and some of my buddies and I was self-contained, I didn't have to be drunk. Where I could just listen to music and I could be happy, I didn't have to be laying on the floor wiped out. What happened to that guy? I know he's in here somewhere. If I could just release him. And I know the key, when I get here, is I just have to stop drinking. So I'm not really interested in doing any of this. So that's my first step. So it seems inadequate, doesn't it? It doesn't seem perfect. And it's not. But it's perfect for the newcomer. Because whatever gets me from one to two is the main thing. And two, I don't believe in God. You think that's a problem? No problem. My sponsor said, don't worry about it. God believes in you. Let's go. Are you willing to believe in God? I said, well, you're playing word games. He goes, I'm not playing word games. Are you willing to believe? I go, well, what's the difference? He goes, well, if you get on your knees at night and your knees in the morning and you pray to God to keep you sober and thank him for keeping you sober, right? And you don't believe in God, that looks like willingness. He goes, you're holding hands with men that you don't know and you're saying a prayer you don't believe in. Looks like willingness to me. He goes, the rest of the stuff will work out. Let's get going. Third step is about you. Isn't that funny? You think it's about me. Oh, I got to make this big decision, turn my will and life over to the care of God. I don't know if I can do it. What if I can't trust him? Because that's what the third step feels like when you're new, right? Your sponsor takes you over to the edge of a cliff and says, look down. You look down and you see the abyss. And then he calmly says, jump. And you say, you jump. And he goes, I already did. Well, if I jump, what are you going to be doing? Well, we're going to be watching. Because that's what they tell you. That's what they told me. The essence of the third step, come with us, join us, do what we do, go where we go, and we absolutely guarantee you we have no idea what's going to happen to you. But the third step's really about you. Because by the time I'm at the third step, I've fallen in love with you. By the time I get to the third step, I believe you. By the time I get to the third step, there's been enough identification with your experience, strength, and hope that I want what you have, and I'm willing to go to any length to get it. And I've noticed a pattern by that time in Alcoholics Anonymous that all the men and women seem to be giving the credit to their good life to this same power I don't believe in, this God I don't believe in. Everybody's giving credit to that power. So I don't know that I believe in God, and I don't even know if I want a relationship with, but I want what you have, and I'm willing to go to any length to get it. So I want what you have, and that's a relationship with this power. And that's all I do in the third step. I make a decision to have a relationship with the power that you have a relationship with. And what I find out is the way that I'm going to fire up that relationship and then develop it is steps 4 through 9. So I have to be very clear that in the third step I haven't done anything except really make a decision that I'm going to do the work required to have this loving relationship with something at that point I don't even believe in. That's how powerful AA and God are. Right? That I don't even have to believe in God. I don't even have to intellectually understand it. You can't connect the dots to a guy like me and show me how this is going to work, and it doesn't matter. All I have to do is make a decision and follow through with the actions contained in steps 4 through 9. So I find myself at step 4, right? So when do you do a 4-step? That's a fun question. Hey, we get that all the time. When do you work the steps? I don't know. When do you want to get well? These are the steps we took, which are suggested as a program of recovery. It's not 90 and 90. It's not setting up. It's not cleaning up. It's not quoting the book back and forth. Right? That's all important, though. I did all that stuff. right? 14 meetings a week with commitments my first 2 years, right? Lived in AA. I believe in that. I believe in a physical demonstration in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I believe a moving target is harder to hit.
Yeah.
Right? I believe that distraction, when you're new, should be labeled as a spiritual tool. Right? Keep me busy.
Yeah.
You want to screw me up when I'm new? Just sit me at a table alone and go, Don, we want you to think about your life for about 15 minutes. We'll be back to check on you. You know? You'll come back in 15 minutes and I'll just be swinging back and forth, you know? Keep me busy. My feet are my friends. But when do we work the steps? When do we do a four-step? Well, there's a clue. Go to the bottom of page 63. Last paragraph, first word. Next. So there's our first clue on when we write our four-step after we finish our third step, after we make this declaration, this decision to have a relationship with this power in the third step. The book says, next. We launched out on a course of vigorous action. The course of vigorous action is steps 4 through 9. The first step of which is a personal house cleaning, which many of us have never attempted. That is step 4, this personal house cleaning. Though our decision, step 3, we're at the top of page 64 for those that are interested, though our decision was a vital and crucial step, it could have little permanent effect unless at once, another timeline clue. So now we've got two of them. We got next. And at once. So the next time somebody goes, well, when do you think I should write my inventory? Next. And at once. Like right now. Well, I didn't mean like right. Why not? Let me get some paper and pencil. Hold, pump the brakes. You'll freaking newcomer out. I'll tell you. But if you got one in front of you that doesn't know whether they should start writing, grab them, get your book, get them in a corner, and get them lined out. I'm telling you, that window of opportunity seems to open and close pretty quick with this stuff. At once followed by a strenuous effort to be rid of the things in ourselves which had been blocking us. Our liquor was but a symptom. We had to get down to causes and conditions. Now there's another clue, right? Liquor's but a symptom. We have to get down to causes and conditions. Alcoholics Anonymous, the big book, Bill Wilson's writing, the first 100 men and women, are already setting me up. They're going, perhaps, I know what you're saying. I know the destruction of your life. Right along every negative aspect. Every heartache, every broken plan, every broken dream, there's a drink of liquor right there with it. I know you're convinced that's the problem, but you're getting me ready. What you're trying to do is get me open-minded to the idea that liquor isn't the culprit, right? That there's something inside me, and you've already introduced me to some ideas by reading this book, spiritual malady, right? Spiritual sickness. I hear you guys talking about character defects and things in the meeting. I don't hear you blaming liquor for the way you're having problems still in sobriety in life. I hear you talk about how your self-will is causing you unease. Everything we read about leading up to taking that third step re-identifies the problem. One of the most important things that happens in the third step has to happen before we go into the fourth step. Which is, we go into the third step still thinking that alcohol's the enemy and the whiskey's the culprit. But in the third step, it says, selfishness, self-centeredness, that we believe is the root of our trouble, driven by 100 forms of fear, self-seeking, self-delusion, and self-pity. We step on the toes of our fellows and they retaliate, and you know the rest of it. So what we've done, we've re-identified the problem. Very important thing that happens before we even get it into writing inventory is we go from knowing whiskey's the problem to knowing that we're the problem. And here's why this is so essential. I'm 63 years old. I've been some places. I've seen some things. I've done some things, just like all of you. To this moment in time, I have yet to work on a problem or bring it to God. Work on a problem or bring it to God that I don't have. Have you ever worked on a problem you don't have? You ever done a spot check, 10-step inventory about your marriage? Taking a good look at it and said, well, I'm right. She's dead wrong. It's right there on paper. But I think I'm going to change anyway. Doesn't work that way. Until I'm the problem, there's nothing I can do. Until I'm the problem, AA don't have a solution for me. Until I'm the problem, I can't go to my creator and go, Dad, This is what I'm doing now, and I can't stop it. So it's very important that I understand the root of my troubles is selfishness and self-centeredness. And we like to talk about selfishness and self-centeredness as though it's something that we were walking down the street one sunny day, minding our own business, and it attached itself to us. Damn, selfishness. I didn't even ask for this. Oh, it's back on me, you know. We talk about selfishness and self-centeredness. That's just us. You can call it your ego. You can call it your being. But we want to believe it's something that we can disrobe of, that we can discard. And what we can do, really, it is a part of us. And it's something that we learn not to live with, but how to basically take it off center stage, where it's the lead actor in the drama of our life, and push God to where he rightly should be in the front. And now God's the creator, God's the leader, God's the director, right? God's the principal, we're his agents. That's what we're trying to have this new attitude about who's on center stage. And when I got here, it was my selfishness and self-centeredness. You know, I want to mention it, but I don't know if I could say his name without crying. Don Majors just passed recently. And he's a huge influence of mine. And those of you that know Don know how wonderful he was. And Don said something every time I ever heard him speak. And he said, without divine intervention, I will always let how I feel be the most important thing in the universe. And he was a believer that he needed to have God's help just to get to God. And I love the humility and the simplicity of that man's spiritual message, and I'll miss him greatly. He helped me tremendously and helped many of us tremendously. So now we're on the fourth step. We're going to giddy up. We're going to get busy. Therefore, we started on this personal inventory. This is step four. And what we're going to do on the first paragraph on page 64 is all good storytellers will use analogies to get their point across, or they'll give you something that you can wrap your head around to give you a point of reference. And what Bill does in this case is he uses a commercial inventory, right? The business inventory. A business that takes no regular inventory usually goes broke. Taking a commercial inventory is a fact-finding, fact-facing process. It's an effort to discover the truth about the stock and trade. One object is to disclose damaged or unsaleable goods to get rid of them promptly and without regret. If the owner of the business is to be successful, he cannot fool himself about values. Next paragraph, next line on page 64, very important, says, we did exactly the same thing with our lives. Not kind of like, not sort of like, not use this as a kind of a rule of thumb. We did exactly the same thing with our lives. So how are we going to do inventory in the fourth step? We're going to do it in a business-like, commercial-like setting. We're going to honestly and objectively look at the stock and trade. What's the stock and trade? Us. Our lives. The way we live. That's our business. What are we looking for? Damaged or unsaleable goods. What is it about myself that's damaged? What is it about myself that I can't sell to you? These old ideas, these resentments, this way I feel about life that you're not buying. Where you look at me and you go, you're crazy. I go, I'm crazy, you're crazy. If the owner of the business is to be successful, I can't fool myself about values. Two words really important when I write inventory, right? One is discover, and the other is value. Discover and value. Discover means new information. I'm not looking to find out if I'm right. A lot of times we do that with inventory, don't we? We do inventory to find out if we're right. That's not why we do inventory. We do inventory to discover. We are looking for new information. I already know what I know. I don't need you or inventory to tell me what I know. Here's the thing. I've never changed from what I know. I've never got relief from what I know. It is a limited solution. No one person can know everything they need to know. If you want to increase your value, start learning what you don't know. Inventory is a process of discovery, new information. and value. See, what we're going to do is we're going to slow down just enough that we're going to start to assign value to some things in our life. I have things in my life when I start writing inventory for the first time, I don't even know where I got them. Do you? These prejudices, these old ideas, I'm not sure where they came from, but they feel true to me. And I've never really stopped and thought about it. You know, it's like, I learned this in AA. You know, I thought I was a good listener. And what I did is I was good at assimilating interest. I can look at you, and I can have the appropriate nod, and I throw sound effects in. Oh. And then you learn to positive, and then what did they say, you know? But the way I listen, I used to listen this way. I used to listen to see if I agreed or disagreed with what you're saying. That's how I listen my whole life. I just listen to see if I agree or disagree with what you're saying. And if I disagree with what you're saying, while you're talking and I look like I'm interested, I'm actually forming an argument. AA said, that's not how we listen. I said, well, how are you supposed to listen? We listen to understand. It's a completely different form of listening. I'm trying to figure out where you're coming from. I'm trying to see what your point of view is. Where do you think that AA and people in AA learn that? They learn it from inventory. And we're going to get to that fourth column in a moment here. So I'm interested in value. I'm going to slow down enough to really give myself permission to go, how valuable are these things in my life? These fears, these resentments, my behavior, my intimate relationships. How valuable is it? I must think it's valuable. Why? Because I've been doing it my whole life. If I don't think it's valuable, then why do I do it? Why am I the Pez dispenser of resentment? Why do I get resentment so freely? And the minute I discard one, another one springloads into place. I'm always in some low level state of resentment. The names and players change, but the resentment stays the same. I have a resentment based life. I move through the world in a constant state of judgment of people, places, and things, and I naturally see where you're not hitting the mark. I do the same thing, do exactly the same thing with my life. I take stock honestly. I search out the flaws of my makeup, which caused my failure. Being convinced itself manifested in various ways is what had defeated us. We considered its common manifestations. What does that mean? Third step, selfishness and self-centeredness is the root of my trouble. I believe that. Okay, now I'm going to see, how does it show up in my life? It's easy for me to, you know, be in AA and learn the language and go, well, I'm so selfish. I am so selfish. I just wake up thinking about me. I go through the day thinking about, how does that show up in your life? Yeah, but how does it show up in your life? What do you mean? Give me an example of what your selfishness looks like in your relationships, in your business dealings, in the way you drive down the road, in the way that you act in the supermarket, the way you talk to your children, the way you gossip about the other church members. And they, people start getting uncomfortable when you ask them that. Well, that's a bit, you know, that's a bit much, you know. So I want to consider, and consider is just what you think. I'm going to think about it. It's a contemplative state, which, side note, there is a speed, a pace, a rate, if you will, to self-will, and a speed, pace, or rate to God's will. Okay? Self-will is reactive. It's very fast. And it may not look fast, but why did you say that? Well, I just didn't think. You're right, you didn't. Because it's a reactive speed. When I'm in self-will, everything speeds up. Everything feels like an emergency, too. You notice that? It's like, well, just wait till tomorrow. Pray about it. No, they die tonight. Saddle up, boys. Tonight we ride. You know? And if I had to use a word to describe God's will, the word would be contemplative. The slowest waiting room in the world is God's waiting room. Feels that way to me. I never go into God's waiting room with a little deal. Now, you might think it's a little deal. Can't believe she said that to me. Now I'm in God's waiting room. God's in God. You think we say no emergencies? We got that from God. There's no emergencies in God's world. It's a contemplative. We slow down, calm down before we do anything. So, I'm going to consider the common manifestations. How does it show up in my life? I'm going to look at three different areas: resentments, fears of my behavior, my intimate relationships, and my personal relationships. Okay? You want to throw in family relationships? You could do that too. I mean, however you want to do it, but the book is specific about those three areas: resentment, fear, sex. So, and if I look at those closely to the best of my ability, I'm going to get a pretty good overview, not of my life. What if I miss something? Will I get drunk? You're not that important.
No.
Or that interesting. Sorry. I want to get a pretty good overview of what? How am I cutting God out of my life? If I've come to believe in the futility and hopelessness of the life as I have been living it, if I've come to believe that my only hope for survival and a shot at being happy, joyous, and free is having a relationship with this power, if I've come to believe that anything that tampers with, interferes with, blocks, or diminishes the strength of that relationship with that power could be labeled fatal. If I come to believe in that, then it's not really about getting to know myself, is it? It's about getting to know what cuts me off from the power. And when I say the power, I mean God, but I say that so I don't want to make anybody uncomfortable. I use the word God because that's what I'm comfortable with, and I have the microphone. So, this is not, oh my goodness. Everything out in the world creeps into Alcoholics Anonymous. Realm of the Spirit is what we have here, but things that are not Realm of the Spirit will creep their way into Alcoholics Anonymous, and we will turn inventory into therapy. And I hear it in AA, I've heard it since I got sober. This is a journey back to self. This is a discovery process of who I am. I remember I heard that crap when I was new. God, I liked it. Because I'm looking for an explanation. Why did I burn my life to the ground? Why did I stay in the water so long? Why did I hurt everybody so? I want somebody to blame other than myself. And I'd hear people say, I don't know who I am. I came to AA and I found out I really didn't know who I am, what I like, and I'm here to find out who I am and what I like. And it's a journey of discovery of who I am. And so it sounded great to me. I went to my sponsor. And I said, I found out what's wrong with me. And he goes, oh, terrific, do tell. And I proudly announced to him, I said, I don't know who I am. And he didn't miss a beat. He goes, that's easy, Don, you're an asshole. So sorry for the language, that's what he said. And he said, now that we got that out of the way, we can work the steps. I thought it was harsh, too, but. Okay, how do we write a first part? Three-part inventory: resentment, fear, sex. Let's start the first part. Let's talk about resentment. First thing we want to do is we want to understand why we're doing this. So Bill spent some time in the book, and I don't think there's anything more definitive than the last paragraph, page 64. Resentment's the number one offender. It destroys more alcoholics than anything else. We can stop there, can't we?
Yeah.
Now, you can make a list of 100 things to destroy alcoholics. This is number one. Chances are, in anything, if you take care of the biggest problem, there's a lot of problems to get taken care of with that. You follow me? Like, you got a leaky pipe in your house? Now, it may be ruining the ceiling, which will ruin the floor, which will ruin the basement, which will ruin all the furniture. You may want to take care of the pipe first, and it'll stop the damage in the other area. So that's where we're going to look at this resentment. Destroys more alcoholics than anything else. Why? From it stem all forms of spiritual disease. Wouldn't that be a fun topic? You know, next time you're in a discussion meeting, ask for a topic, go spiritual disease and see what happens there. And we all have different words to describe what we think a spiritual disease is, right? Judgment of others, gossip, the seven deadly sins. And you, by the way, you're not wrong on any of them. Whatever pops, you're probably right. But resentment seems to be the genesis stone. It seems to be the launching place. And why is that? I am perfectly imperfect. I am a human being. I am designed for communion with my Heavenly Father, to have my thoughts and actions directed by this power. When I'm in that sweet spot of simply doing what I think God would have me do, with no real idea whether I'm accurate or not, I'm just trying to approach my life the way the Father would have me do things, right? Just that simple thing. A lot of stuff falls off for me. In fact, my character defects really don't have a chance when I'm living there. But when I don't have that approach to my life, boy, a lot of really bad stuff can happen really quick. It's almost as though I'm two people. When I live with God and I don't live with God, the results and the actions are so very different. So the thing about this resentment is, when I'm in a resentful state, nothing will so effectively cut me off from God than being resentful. Example, you ever been really angry? And by the way, I'm not talking about annoyed or perturbed. I'm talking about obsessed with the problem. Obsession, when I think of little or nothing else, right? And you just grinding. And then somebody goes, well, pray about that. I don't know what your prayers sound like. God, I'm really upset with Chuck. I can't believe he said that to me. God, if you could, I don't want him to suffer, but if it was a quick death, just a quick death, I think I'd be okay with that. Yeah. Oh, you'll pray all right, but probably not along the lines of what we suggest. I can't pray. I am cut off. And my very existence, if I stay in that state long enough, I'm going to drink again. This is a promise. Not all the promises in the big book are sweet, but they're all accurate. So I'm going to drink again if I stay in this state. We can call it infinitely grave to live in resentment. So now I understand why it's so important. And down on the bottom, it tells us something very important. We have not only been mentally and physically ill, we have been spiritually sick. Here's the order of recovery in Alcoholics Anonymous. When the spiritual malady is overcome, this relationship I have with Dad, my Heavenly Father, is busted. It's busted. It needs to be fixed. He's waiting. God didn't move, I moved. Right? I gotta come home. And there's a lot of stuff between me and my Heavenly Father I gotta get out of the way. Okay? So, when that malady is overcome, I straighten out both mentally and physically. Now, you would think that that means my thoughts suddenly straighten out. I'm not as big a whack job. And physically, I get my health back. That's not the planes we're talking about. Okay? When the spiritual malady is overcome, when God and I suddenly, we start hitting on all eight cylinders, and now I have a good relationship with God, I straighten out mentally, which means my thought life. Now, here's the thing about my thought life. You can't hear it, but I can feel it. Yeah. Right? I walk around with a smile on my face. Inside, oh, it's stormy. Yeah. How are you? Fine. How are you? My thought life straightens out. And it says I straighten out physically. When we talk about, you got to realize, when they wrote the book, they were in the metaphysics a lot. They were reading a lot of other literature. When they talk about the physical world, they talk about the world and the people in it. Question to me, when I'm in a resentful state, how's your relationship with the world and the people in it? What do we say? What is one of the most common things new people say to their first sponsor? Because we want our sponsors to understand what they're dealing with, the challenge that lies ahead, right? And we say things like this, not for nothing, but I think it's important that you know, I don't like authority. Oh, really? Well, we've never heard that in AA before. And no, it gets worse. I'm really not a people person. Oh, shocking, you know. We come here pretty convinced we don't like people. You know why that is? You know who I like? You know who I like? I like people that like me. That's called logical. Guess what happens when you're pretty sure nobody likes you? It makes it really hard to like anyone. When the spiritual malady is overcome, my thoughts stop being so torturous and I start getting along with the rest of God's kids. Spiritual malady is overcome. You know what's weird? You get better.
Yeah.
Isn't that something? My relationship with God gets into the right order. You get better. It's wonderful that he was willing to work on you while he was working on me. Isn't that nice? So now I'm going to start writing inventory. I'm going to write my first column out. And this shouldn't be hard. I mean, I've been living with that stuff. I wake up in the morning and I'm thinking about it. I walk in the rooms and I see people and it reminds me of it, but I hate them. And so it's pretty simple, you know. It's like my friend Sheldon says, I could write your first column resentment inventory for you. Mom, dad, first girlfriend, last girlfriend, every girl you ever dated, you know, everybody in your family, first boss, last boss, you know, the government, you know, just basic stuff. We all got the same resentments, right? So we list them down. And we've been doing that our whole life. So just list everything down. We're going to do that. And then on page 65, you turn over, and before it gets to the diagram, there's a little throwaway sentence, but I think it's the most important sentences in the big book. That's why I have it highlighted. And it's not for the person writing inventory. Isn't that something? Because remember, it's not all about us anymore. Right? It's about the rest of God's kids too. In this case, it's about our sponsors. It says this: we were usually as definite as this example. And then it shows the columns written out. What that means is you don't have to write any more than this. You don't need to write an autobiography. We're not going to grade it. We're not going to say, I got to tell you, this is the best inventory I've ever seen. Your punctuation was killer. It was unbelievable. And the way you set this scene, it was a dark and stormy night. I had a sense of foreboding as I left my apartment. You know, oh my God, I felt like I was there with you again. We write inventory like we're not going to be there in the fifth step. Here's a clue. You're going to be there. Write a list. Write a list, just enough that I don't forget what I want to talk about. By the way, it's less of a paper trail.
Yeah.
Just saying. I will give you an example of how little you have to write. I'll tell you about my biggest, darkest, deepest resentment. The juggernaut resentment. The genesis resentment. The resentment that made all other resentments in my life possible, okay? My father. So, here's what I wrote about my father. Column 1, I'm resentful at my father. Column 2, which is the cause. Column 2, the cause. What did he do? He left and never looked back. Column 3, right? What does it affect? My whole damn life. Column 4, which we're going to get to, by the way, I left blank. That's all I had. Now, that doesn't sound like much. I want to be clear, I could talk for 6 hours straight without taking a breath about the deep-seated hatred I had for this man when I got sober. You know, this is a guy that left my mother pregnant with her third child and myself and my older sister in poverty in a tough neighborhood. Left and never looked back. Never sent a dime of welfare. I grew up without having a man to show me how to do things. I grew up getting my ass kicked every other week without somebody telling me that it was going to be okay, standing up for me. I could go on. See how it rolls off the tongue? You know why? It's practiced. By the time I come to AA, I've been telling that story of victimization for 29 years at that point. Right? And I'm convinced you're not moving me off that point. That's what we call what? Justifiable resentment. You bet. Right? And that's okay. It doesn't matter. The point I'm trying to make here is I didn't have to write a lot. I'm not going to forget that stuff. I think a lot of us get stuck in inventory thinking we got to write everything down and we get overwhelmed. That's the other thing. If I could write that briefly, I'm resentful at my father. He left and never looked back. Affects my whole life. I'm done. If I could be that brief on the worst one, let's agree, I'm not going to get overwhelmed. Imagine if I wrote everything. My first heartbreak and he wasn't there. First time I got my butt kicked and he wasn't there. first time I had to go and they said, where's your dad, when I went for signups and he wasn't there. You know, on and on and on. If I have to write all that stuff, do you think when I'm done writing about my dad, I'm going to go on to my next entry? Or am I going to throw my pen down and go, this is too hard, this is too much, and slam the book? And I think many of us get overwhelmed being too explicit, thinking we have to write everything down. You're writing a list. So column one, write the list. Now we're going to look at columns two and three. And by the way, column one, two, and three should write themselves. This is not a big deal. We've been doing this our whole life. Go to the top of page 66. Second line, right in the middle there, it says, to conclude that others were wrong was usually as far as most of us ever got. That's where we're at. Right? You've been concluding that it was other people's fault your whole life, haven't you? I have. So those are the, we're going to write the three columns to prove that they're wrong. Who they are, what they did, and what we think it affects. Right? And we're going to use the words from the big book. And if you don't know what those are, get your sponsor to define them for you. My self-esteem, my security. You know, what do you think it affects? We're going to get that done. And then we're going to have it all done, and then we're going to do a very important exercise. Bottom of page 66. We got our three columns and our resentment list. And we're kind of proud of this. That's right. Yeah. Wait till they get a load of this stuff. They're going to realize it. What? Because we get here, right? We get here and they hand us a book. We start reading the big book and we're flipping through it looking for the chapter, right? What to do when you know it's their fault. You know, we just got to be here somewhere. And it just isn't. It's really, really infuriating. So I got my first three columns done, feeling pretty good about that. If I wasn't sure it was their fault before, I am positive now. And now we're going to do an exercise. You go down to the bottom of page 66, last paragraph, or second to last paragraph. It says, we turn back to the list. Our list now has three entries on it, right? We're going to list the people that were resentful, people, places, or institutions were resentful at, or principles. We're going to list what the cause was, what they did, and what we think it affects, right? We got that written down. We're going to turn to that list, and it says, for it held the key to the future. We were prepared to look at it from an entirely different angle. If you read in the big book something that says, it held the key to the future, if you read something that says, fatal, if you read something that says, vital, yeah, highlight it, pay attention. This held the key to the future. That's what I'm here for. I can't do anything about the past. I'm here for this new future you're promising me. And supposedly, these three columns held the key to it if I'm willing to look at it from an entirely different angle. Well, if I'm going to look at something from an entirely different angle, what's the angle I've been looking at it from? Top of page 66. To conclude that others were wrong was usually as far as most of us got. That's the old angle. We're going to set that aside and we're going to do an exercise. And when it says this was our course, that means this is the path. This is a direction. This is the instructions of what we're going to do before we write our fourth column. You do not get to write your fourth column unless you do this. Unless you can take it from your head to your heart, don't even bother. And that means effort. Remember, we read previously that what we're going to engage in is a strenuous effort to rid ourselves of the things that have been blocking us off from God. This is going to be an example of strenuous. This is not easy. Hear that. This is not easy. We're talking about dealing with people that we resent, i.e. hate. And we're going to try to change our mind about that. Doesn't sound easy, does it? Because it's not. And if you've never done it before, it's tough. Because it's a whole new set of spiritual tools many of us have never used before. So the first thing I'm going to do is I'm going to realize that people who wronged us were perhaps spiritually sick. Why does that ring a bell? The people that wronged us were perhaps spiritually sick. Strangely familiar. Where have I heard that before? Oh, yeah, my sponsor keeps telling me I'm spiritually sick. Oh, yeah, AA in the big book keeps telling me I suffer from a spiritual malady. Huh. In one sentence, right in the beginning, if I'm open-minded, most important element you can have in this alchemy of inventory is open-mindedness. but open-minded, one sentence, perhaps they're spiritually sick. I've gone from what? State of superiority to same as. Ooh, that's a big jump for one sentence. Wouldn't you agree? Though I did not like their symptoms, column two. Though I did not like their symptoms, column two, the cause, what they did. Yeah, I don't like your symptoms. I don't like that dad left and never looked back. Column two, I don't like their symptoms. And the way they disturbed us, column three, affects my whole damn life. That man left and it affects my whole damn life. I don't like his symptoms. I don't like the way they disturb me. We're agreeing with you. Yeah. Yeah, he was wrong. Yeah, that's not fair. We're not saying you gotta like it. We're not saying you gotta, it's a spiritual exercise, you know, that you run my foot over with your tire and I say, I'm sorry, my foot was in the way of your tire. That's not what we're asking you to do. To embrace abuse, please. We're telling you we get it. Though we did not like their symptoms, what they did and the way they disturbed us, how it left me feeling, they, like ourselves, were sick too. I can't do this. I'm not noble enough. I don't want to be this good. I can't get there on my own. You don't understand that the fabric of my existence is shot through with these threads of resentment. It's who I am. I don't know who I am if I don't have this hatred. And that's why we have to bring God into it. And at this point, we start to pray. We ask God to help show them the same tolerance, pity, and patience we would cheerfully grant a sick friend. So let's stop and think about a sick friend. You ever had a relative go through cancer? Loved one? You ever have a relative or a loved one go through something really heavy? You ever have them act poorly towards you? You ever have them bite your head off? You ever had them unappreciative of your efforts? Could you park any further away? No, Mom, that's the best I'm doing, Mom. You know. But it's not that hard to grant them tolerance, patience, and pity, is it? We're able to comfort ourselves by going, you know, they're just not themselves. They don't feel good. I know what it's like not to feel good. Sometimes I'm a chore when I don't feel good. Sometimes I'm impatient when I don't feel good. Sometimes I'm unthinking, inconsiderate when I don't feel good. And it's easy to do that with somebody that we see physically sick or suffering from something that's, gosh, I'm so sorry you're going through this. But we don't look at spiritual sickness that way, because I can't see it and only you can feel it. You can't see mine, but buddy, I'm feeling it. And so what we're striving for here is identification and compassion. I begin to realize I'm not better than you. I'm not worse than you. I'm just like you. We say things like everybody's got their own cross to bear, but do we believe it? Do I look at you as an imperfect child of God and I know that you're carrying a load that I can't see, but I know you're carrying one because everybody does. And this is the beginning of true compassion and empathy. And I have to ask God to help me do this, because I can't do it. I'm not that noble. And then it says, when a person offends, we say to ourselves, this is a sick man. How can I be helpful to him? God save me from being angry. Thy will be done. So now I have marching orders, not just for the resentment I'm dealing with, but for the future. This is my direction. You know, this is why we take what we learn in the step and we carry it into the next step and we carry it into the rest of our sobriety. This is direction. When a person offends today, right? Maybe this is a sick man. Maybe they're spiritually sick just like I am. And I go to God. And I don't say, God, make them better. God, show them the error of their ways. I say, God, save me from being angry. Yeah. You know why? I know what I'm like when I'm angry. I don't know what your mantra is in your head, but when I start to feel it, this is what I say in my head. Easy there, bucko. You know how you get. Because I know how I get, and I don't like it. And I will go to God. And Dad and I will have a laugh about how I get. Because I just can't, I don't have room for it in my life. And it doesn't mean I don't get angry anymore, but boy, I'm a damn sight less angry than I used to be. Now, I want to stop right there on page 67. I don't want to point something out. And there's something that's been a part of AA since I got sober, and I know where it comes from. It comes from a beautiful story in the back of the big book called Freedom from Bondage. And I'll tell you what the story says. The story says this woman had 100 resentments, and she ran them through the process, and she got rid of 99 of them. She had 100. She got rid of 99 of them. 99 resentment-free is one she couldn't shake. It was Mom. Ooh, we all know that one, right? And she just tried and she tried and she tried. She couldn't get rid of it. She's talking to somebody else. Somebody goes, you know, I read this article in this newspaper when I was in the waiting room at a doctor's office. And it said if you pray for that person that they have everything you'd want for yourself, you'll be free of the resentment. And out of desperation, she said, what the hell? I'll pray for her. And she prayed for Mama, who she was resentful at, and she got rid of the resentment. Isn't that wonderful? What a great story. That became direction in Alcoholics Anonymous. And it ain't. It ain't in the book. It's a personal story, somebody's personal experience. Here's the problem I have. You want to pray for people you're resentful at? Have at it after you've run it through the columns. Because here's the problem. If I get resentful at you, I'm living... I'm the top of page 66. To conclude that others were wrong was usually as far as most of us got. Right? I haven't done any column work. I'm resentful at you. You're the problem. Sucks to be you. Sorry you're spiritually sick. I will pray to God because God, they're so sick. And I hear this stuff in AA. It makes me crazy. You know, somebody will come in the meeting and they'll raise their hand to share and they go, well, I had a tough day with my sister-in-law. You know, the girl can't help it. She's just a slut, you know. And, oh. But she can't help it because she's spiritually sick and she needs a program, but she don't have one. But I'm doing what AA taught me. I'm praying for her. I'm praying that she has everything that I would want for myself and that she's happy. And I hear this kind of stuff in AA, and what we end up doing is screwing ourselves out of something that we value very highly in AA. It's called the truth. I will never get to the truth of what's really going on unless I go through this. So I'm not going to pray for you. I'm going to run it through the columns. And here's my thing. If you have 100 resentments and you get rid of 99 of them going through the process, you got one left, fine, pray. I don't care. But take it through the process. Get some real freedom. Because the freedom didn't come from realizing you were sick and it wasn't my fault. The freedom came from realizing you were sick just like me, and how dare I judge God because he made us both and we're the same. I cannot judge you and not judge myself. And I don't want... The forgiveness I ask for in the Lord's Prayer is very clear that I'm going to get it in the measure I'm willing to give it. And yet I sit there, judge, jury, and executioner of you, but I want to be forgiven for my transgressions, and I lived a horrible life. I want you to be very clear about that. I got no room to judge. Yet I do a lot of it. We should be the least judgmental people on the planet. Are we? No. Anyway. So now it's going to give me some helpful hints. I avoid retaliation or argument. I wouldn't treat sick people that way. I'll destroy a chance to be helpful. Because underneath all this, I'm fitting myself to be a maximum service to God and the people about me. It's not about me anymore. Self is the problem. This is about a life of service. If I'm going to serve you, I can't hate you. If I'm going to help you, I can't hate you. I got to find a way to connect with you. I got to find a way to be equal to you, not better than you. When I pray for people, I always pray from a position of superiority, never inferiority. So now what I'm going to do is I'm going to look at my list and I'm ready, right? I've taken a spiritual exercise. I've prepared myself to write a fourth column. And the preparation has left me with a feeling as I go into it, man, I thought it was them. I blame them. I demonize them. And I realized by looking at this that I've done everything that they've done. And now I can really, putting out of my mind the wrongdoings of others, I can resolutely look for my own mistakes and ask some questions. Where was I selfish? Where was I dishonest? Where was I inconsiderate? Where was I afraid? That doesn't mean that Dad didn't leave, and it doesn't mean that he's not a bad guy. It doesn't mean that it didn't affect my life negatively. All that's true. People come here with horrible stories of abuse and things that she said have never happened to them. We're not telling you it didn't happen, and we're not telling you it's okay. It shouldn't have happened, and it was never okay. It'll never be okay. But we're just asking you to set it aside. If I'm holding on to it, it's going to be very hard to look at myself objectively. Because that's my explanation. Yeah, I hurt you, but look at what you did. Yeah, I hurt you, but remember when that. I wouldn't have done this if you hadn't have done that. It's my justification and rationalization argument. I begin to see the value of it. It's an explanation for a poorly lived life. Because it's really not my fault. If you had seen what I had seen and been through what I've been through, maybe you'd have turned out the way I did. So maybe you want to walk a mile in my shoes before you judge me. And that keeps me locked in the bondage of self. And I don't know about you, but I want to get free. And if I'm going to get free, I've got to be free of resentment. So I resolutely look for my own mistakes. I ask myself those questions and I find answers. But I'll tell you, this is very important, and you know, I'll pick this up, you know, I'll save this when we talk about the fifth step. I'm going to giddy up here. And we go to our fear inventory. Fear inventory is easy. That's easy, right? List your fears down. Everybody's got the same fears. I'm a fear of success. I'm a fear of failure. I'm a fear of intimacy. I'm a fear of being alone. You know, I get, it's like, just write down everything under the sun and some stuff I don't have words for. Right? We are fear-based people. Fear is a normal part of life. And you know, we get sober a while and we think we outgrow fear. And what we do is we get cuter with the way we describe fear, right? Well, I'm not really afraid. Your sponsor goes, you seem like you're in fear. Oh, no, I'm not in fear. I'm just informed and concerned, you know. I'm not resentful, I'm perturbed, you know. Let's use the words in the big book. I'm in fear. Boy, and guys will know, man, we don't like to say that. I'd rather be angry than afraid. I mean, it took me 10 years in sobriety to find out, this is really weenie, that I wasn't angry, but I got my feelings hurt a lot. I'd be furious with somebody, and I'd go, oh, man, that guy really pissed me off. My sponsor goes, he didn't piss you off. He hurt your feelings. I'd be like, oh. Because suddenly I'm 7 years old, but walking home alone from the playground crying. Yeah. I don't have any friends, you know. Just, I'd rather be angry than afraid, you know what I mean? But we start using language of the big book, right? We stop minimizing stuff. You know why? Don't be ashamed of being human. I get afraid every day about something that I have to deal with, bring to God. And all the fear exercise is this. This is it. There's a difference between believing in God and relying on God. It takes a long time for some of us to just get to belief. And we want to announce it to everybody. I came to AA and I didn't believe in God. And today I do. Oh. I'm sure God is very impressed. He made you. He's always believed in you, you know. But we think it's like a revelation. And I get it. I was the same way. But there's a big difference between believing in God and relying on God. That fear exercise is going to show us why we have to rely on God. Why do I have the fear? If self-reliance didn't fail me, why do I have the fear? Well, can't you just figure it's going to be fine no matter what happens, Doc? Can't you do this on your own? No. Because in a self-centered state, I have requirements. Things have to go a certain way for me to be serene. You ever notice how God's easy when the wind's at your back and the sun's in your face? Yeah. Things are going your way. How are you? Oh, God and I are like that. What else is going on? Just had the biggest commission month of my sales career. You know, just, gee, I wonder if they're connected, you know, and the... When sales are so bad, I can't give anything away. Why has God deserted me? God's running the universe and playing puppeteer with my sales life. You know, not likely. Self-reliance, the folly of self-reliance. What are things that trigger me thinking that self-reliance works again? Long-term sobriety. I'm 31 years sober. You know the worst thing about being 31 years sober? I know stuff. Just ask me. My God, I'm up here. This is ridiculous, Beth. What am I doing up here, you know? My friends know how perfectly imperfect I am. And I'm telling you, It's the it's the curse of having time and because you know stuff. Because people try to help you like you're sponsoring or talking, and this is your damn self-centered brain. I know. It's my favorite song today. I know. I know everything, you know? I'm not God-reliant, I'm Don-reliant. What I like to do is get the ship moving really fast. Running on self-will, right? In collision with somebody or something. I prefer collision with everything and everybody. That's my goal, is just to bang through life. And then when I crash and burn with a couple of victims with me, usually like my wife or my marriage, my coworkers, and we're in this tangled heap, then I turn to God. Like God is some crazy emotional hazmat crew for the damage of my life. Like he's a butler. I just call on God to get what I need. God ain't a butler. Reliance. Maybe if I practice God-reliance rather than self-reliance, the ship wouldn't get going out of control. Maybe there'd be a calmness about me because I'd be able to actually live in the spirit of the third step. What's the spirit of the third step? None of it's any of my business anymore. I got one job, serve God and his kids. Well, it's got to be more to it than that. Not from what I've read. Now, do I hit that mark? Oh, no. Oh, no. These are perfect ideas, spiritual in nature. None of us ever hit it. But we better know what they are. At least know what the spiritual idea is. Right? Serve God and his kids. So, when I stop being self-reliant in the fear exercise, because I ask God, what do I do? In the fear exercise, I admit I have this fear. I ask God to remove the fear. I ask him to direct my thinking, very important, direct my thinking to what he would have me be. I at once, immediately, begin to outgrow fear. Now, notice it doesn't say lose fear. It says outgrow fear. Here's the thing about alcoholics you need to understand. We are remarkable people. Amy mentioned that, you know, above intelligence, gregarious, charismatic, all true. But I'll tell you what we have a problem with. Getting to the arena of life. We have heads full of fear going, don't go, why would you go? It's not going to work out, they're not going to like you, you're really not that smart. You got some of them fooled, but then they all know you're an idiot. Don't leave the couch. The couch is safe. Stay on the couch. You can't get me to the arena of life, you need a shotgun and a gorilla. I'm holding on to the door jamb going, no, it'll be awful. You're pulling me away. You're going. I don't want to go. And you throw me into the arena of life and I land and I perform and I'm wonderful. And then what happens? My ego steps right in and says, I knew we could do it. That was amazing, Don. Yeah, wasn't it? Wasn't it? I felt that while it was happening, that it was amazing. I'm the same guy in the fetal position that morning going, I don't want to go, right? That's how quickly fear will swing to ego if I get what I want, if I'm in self-reliance. Living in the spirit of the third step is simply this. Hey, man, I'm just trying to do what I think God would have me do. Right? I'm just trying to be a service. I'm just trying to be helpful. And so that's my whole idea. So we learn and we do this fear exercise in our day-to-day living. I've had days, I've got to be complete, 50 times, 75 times in one day where I've had to stop and pray to God to direct my thinking to what he would have me be. Please remove this fear. I keep taking it back. I can't stop thinking about this. And maybe I got 10 minutes of comfort, but it was 10 minutes I wouldn't have had on my own. And eventually the gears mesh and I let go. Just let go of whatever I think that thing that has to go a certain way, because if it doesn't, it'll be the end of me as you know me. Because I'm grandiose. And grandiose doesn't mean that I think I'm better than it. It just means my stuff is bigger than your stuff. Good and bad. Right? And then the sex inventory is like, everybody's got the same sex inventory, right? Ask yourself one question. You answer everything in a book. You write it out the way the book says. And then you ask yourself one question. Am I selfish or not? I've been in a lot of relationships. It's all the same relationship by the time I get to AA. I mean, it's the same. The names change, but the victims stay the same. You know what I mean? It's the same stuff. I found out I didn't know anything about love. I like to talk about it. I didn't know anything about love, but I knew everything there was to know about bartering. You do this for me, I'll do that for you, but you first. Constant state of proving your worth to me, your value to me, and your love of me. And if I don't get those things, I will turn into the actor. I will be kind, considerate, generous, but if that doesn't work, I can be mean, egotistical, and demanding. I'm right from the third step. And when I don't get what I want, I just turn the volume up. On the next occasion, I may be more demanding or more kind. Whatever I think will get me what I really want. This is what I really want. I want what I want when I want it. I say I love you with my mouth, but my actions show that I'm in it for me. I don't know what it's like to be in a relationship when I get to Alcoholics Anonymous. Yet, at that point, I'd lived with several women for several years, been engaged several times, never hit the finish line. I looked like a guy that knew a lot about relationships. Here's the other fun thing that came out of my sexual inventory. Going into it, I would have put my hand on the Bible, I would have sworn, taken a lie detector test, and passed that I'd been faithful in every relationship I ever been in. I wrote my inventory, came out, and I said, oh my God, I cheated in every relationship I've ever been in. And that's how powerful justification and rationalization are. Because in my head it was like this, well, the relationship was over anyway. We just hadn't really officially broken up. Or, you know, I was pretty sure she was cheating on me, so what's the point? Or, you know, I was out of town. And that makes sense in my mind. Or that was just like a one-night thing. It was a one-off. I was drunk. It doesn't mean anything. I've been unfaithful to every relationship I've ever been. Going back to like being 13 years old. But I went in thinking I was a faithful stand-up guy. That's a lack of perception. That was a discovery where I got to find out some new value about these things. You know, I'm running over, but I got to take 5 minutes and just talk about the fifth step. I think the fifth step, in my experience, the best thing about the fifth step is that I've had sponsors that were active participants in my fifth step. I know what I know. One of the warnings, and I think it's spiritual direction for the rest of our life about everything. It's a warning right when we're reading the fifth step in the big book. Okay, there's two warnings. If we skip this vital step, we might get drunk. That's a good warning. I think the other one's just as important. It says, we usually find a solitary self-appraisal insufficient. Yeah. Now, forget that's about the fifth step. In your mind, we find a solitary self-appraisal insufficient. Turn it into a bumper sticker. It's on the mirror in your bathroom. What does that mean? Another problem of being sober a long time. I don't need to talk to people about it. If I yell at my wife, I don't need to tell my sponsor. I mean, I know what to do. I go, hey, honey, I'm sorry I make the heartfelt amends. You know, I make it a piece of spiritual business, and I try not to. Very different than actually taking it to your sponsor and going, I did it again. Yeah. I did it again. Because your sponsor might say, well, did it again? Like, what, you weren't there? You sound like you're surprised. Right? A solitary self-appraisal is insufficient. How guilty am I, now that I've been sober a while, of going back into a secretive kind of a life? Not that I'm doing, I'm like, look, I'm not in the casino, I'm not with the hookers, I'm not doing anything I'm ashamed of, but I'm talking about where I don't trust and I'm the final authority. Have I pulled back into self-reliance, or am I sharing openly and honestly? Do I have somebody in my life, hopefully a sponsor, that I'm transparent with about everything? Because it's funny about being completely transparent with one person, it makes it possible with others. And I'm transparent with a lot of guys, you know, my good friend Steve here, I suppose. Steve knows. Steve, I don't have to say Steve, newsflash, I'm imperfect. We're dear friends that have a sponsor-sponsee relationship, but we talk on the phone very openly and honestly about our imperfection. I mean, I'm transparent with a lot of people, and I like it that way. It's not that it keeps me honest and accountable. Just something about being able to stand up straight and go, here I am. Spend the whole damn day just being yourself. What a relief. Yeah. And be okay with who you are. Not perfect, but okay with who you are. So that fifth step, this idea that a solitary self-appraisal is insufficient, hold on to that. Hold on to that for the rest of our sobriety. That applies to everything. And then the sponsor should be an active member during this inventory. I don't want a sponsor to go, okay, start reading, and then when I'm done reading, good job, I think you did a good job there, and we go home. I know what I know. I need somebody to fill in the blanks. Ask me questions. I'll tell you, I'll give you an example. My fourth column's blank on my first inventory about my dad, right? My sponsor says to me, he goes, Don, three-part inventory. We're on part number one, resentment. Four columns, your fourth column's blank. It's your first resentment. We're not off to a good start. And I start yelling at him. I said, you know the story with my dad. Are you kidding me? How could I have a part in this? How could I be wrong? What mistake could I have? I was 2 years old when he left. He ruined my life. And you expect me to? And he goes, all right, calm down, take a breath. He goes, let me ask you a question. How old were you when you left? I go, you know how old I was. I was 2 years old. He goes, how old are you now? I go, well, I'm 31. He goes, so let me get this straight. For the last 29 years, a man, by your own admission, that you've never known, has completely dominated your life. And I mean, the clouds parted. It's good to have a sponsor. And I want to be clear, I was so dug in and invested in that resentment, I'd have never got there on my own. And when he said, completely dominated your life, the possibility of the resentment going away started. I did not get free of the resentment that day. But I did within the next couple of years because I held on to that idea that came out of the fifth step that my sponsor supplied. And I like this. My friend Sheldon says this all. He goes, I think it'd be better if we just didn't fill out the fourth column on the resentment. Just leave it blank and then just talk about it with your sponsor, because your sponsor is going to be more accurate than you are. Because my sponsor doesn't have my justification and rationalization. I'm like, oh, I know I did some stuff wrong, but can we go back to what they did? And I want to live there. I want to live there today. This is, if I had a shirt that I wore through life, it would say this, guilty with an explanation, Your Honor. I mean, just... AA has allowed me to admit that I'm sometimes wrong. I just can't seem to shake the need to explain to you how it's really not my fault. And that's where I know I still have a lot of work to do. Thanks for listening. Yeah.